glory, and the House of Glass Roses was the most glorious, dangerous place on the Alcigrante slopes. That Don Maranzalla held it was a sign of his high and lasting favour with the Duke. Just before the midpoint of the noon hour the next day, Jean Tannon stood at the door of Don Maranzalla's tower. 5 cylindrical stories of grey stone and silver glass, a hulking fastness that made the lovely villas around it look like an architect's scale models. Great waves of white heat beat down from the cloudless sky, and the air was heavy with the slightly beery breath of a city river boiling under long hours of sun. A frosted glass window was set into the stone beside the tower's huge, lacquered oaken doors, behind which the vague outline of a face could be discerned. Jean's approach had been noted. He'd gone north over the Angevine on a glass catbridge no wider than his hips, clinging to the guide ropes with sweaty hands for all 600 feet of the crossing. There were no large bridges to the south bank of the Isla Zantara, second most easterly of the Alcigrante Islands. Ferry rides were a copper half-baron. For those too poor to ride, that left the ecstatic terror of the cat bridges. Jean had never been aloft on one before, and the sight of more experienced men and women ignoring the ropes as they crossed at speed had turned his bowels to ice water. The feel of hard pavement beneath his shoes had been a blessed relief when it came again. The sweat-soaked yellow jackets on duty at the Isla Zantara gatehouse had let Jean pass far more quickly than he'd thought possible, and he'd seen the mirth drain from their ruddy faces the moment they recognized the sigil he carried. Their directions after that had been terse. Was it pity that tinged their voices, or fear?
"We'll look for you, boy!"
one of them suddenly called after him as he started up the clean white stones of the street.
"If you come back down the hill again!"
Mingled pity and fear, then. Had Jean really been enthusiastic for this adventure as recently as the night before? The creak and rattle of counterweights heralded the appearance of a dark crack between the twin doors before him. A second later, the portal swung wide with slow majesty, muscled outward by a pair of men in blood-red waistcoats and sashes, and Jean saw that each door was 1/2 foot of solid wood backed with iron bands. A wave of scents washed out over him, humid stone and old sweat, roasting meat and cinnamon incense, smells of prosperity and security, of life within walls. Jean held his wallet up to the men who'd opened the door, and one of them waved a hand impatiently.
"You're expected. Enter as a guest of Don Maranzalla and respect his house as you would your own."
Against the left-hand wall of the opulent foyer, a pair of curlicue staircases in black iron wound upward. Jean followed the man around and up one set of narrow steps, self-consciously trying to keep his sweating and gasping under control. The tower doors were pulled shut beneath them with an echoing slam. They wound their way up past 3 floors of glittering glass and ancient stone, decorated with thick red carpets and innumerable stained tapestries that Jean recognized as battle flags. Don Maranzalla had served as the Duke's personal swordmaster and the commander of his black jackets for 1/4 century. These bloody scraps of cloth were all that remained of countless companies of men fate had thrown against Nicovante and Maranzalla in fights that were now legend. The Iron Sea Wars, the Mad Count's Rebellion, the 1,000-day war against Tal Verar. At last the winding stair brought them up into a small dim room, barely larger than a closet, lit by the gentle red glow of a paper lantern. The man placed one hand on a brass knob and turned to look down at Jean.
"This is the garden without fragrance," he said. "Step with care and touch nothing as you love life."
Then he pushed the door to the roof open, letting in a sight so bright and astounding that Jean rocked backward on his heels. The House of Glass Roses was more than twice as wide as it was tall, so the roof must have been at least 100 feet in diameter, walled in on all sides. For a frightful moment, Jean thought he stood before a blazing 100-hued alchemical fire. All the stories and rumors had done nothing to prepare him for the sight of this place beneath the full light of a white summer sun. It seemed as though liquid diamond pulsed through a million delicate veins and scintillated on a million facets and edges. Here was an entire rose garden, wall after wall of perfect petals and stems and thorns, silent and scentless and alive with reflected fire, for it was all carved from elderglass, 100,000 blossoms perfect down to the tiniest thorn. Dazzled, Jean stumbled forward and stretched out a hand to steady himself. When he forced his eyes closed, the darkness was alive with afterimages like flashes of heat lightning. Don Maranzala's man caught him by the shoulders, gently but firmly.
"It can be overwhelming at first. Your eyes will adjust in a few moments. But mark my words well, and by the gods, touch nothing."
As Jean's eyes recovered from the initial shock of the garden, he began to see past the dazzling glare. Each wall of roses was actually transparent. The nearest was just 2 paces away, and it was flawless as the rumors claimed, as though the Eldrin had frozen every blossom and every bush in an instant of summer's fullest perfection. Yet there were patches of genuine color here and there in the hearts of the sculptures, swirled masses of reddish-brown translucence, like clouds of rust-colored smoke frozen in ice. These clouds of color were human blood. Every petal, leaf, and thorn was sharper than any razor. The merest touch would open human skin like paper, and the roses would drink, or so the stories said, siphoning blood deep inside the network of glass stems and vines. Presumably, if enough lives were fed to the garden, every blossom and every wall would some day turn a rich, rusty red. Some rumors had it that the garden merely drank what was spilled upon it. Others claimed that the roses would actually draw blood forth from a wound and could drain a man white from any cut, no matter how small. It would take intense concentration to walk through these paths. Most were only 2 or 3 paces wide, and a moment of distraction could be deadly. It said much about Don Maranzala that he thought of his garden as the ideal place to teach young men how to fight. For the first time, Jean felt a sense of dreadful awe at the creatures who'd vanished from Camor 1,000 years before his birth. How many other alien surprises had they left behind for men to stumble over? What could drive away beings powerful enough to craft something like this? The answer did not bear thinking of. Maranzala's man released his grip on Jean's shoulders and re-entered the dim room at the apex of the stairs. The room, as Jean now saw, jutted out of the tower's wall like a gardener's shack.
"The Don will be waiting at the center of the garden," he said.
Then he pulled the door shut after him, and Jean seemed alone on the roof, with the naked sun overhead and the walls of thirsty glass before him. Yet he wasn't alone. There was noise coming from the heart of the glass garden, the wickering skirl of steel against steel, low grunts of exertion, a few terse commands and a deep voice rich with authority. Just a few minutes earlier, Jean would have sworn that the Catbridge crossing was the most frightening thing he'd ever done, but now that he faced the garden without fragrance, he would have gladly gone back to the midpoint of that slender arch 50 feet above the Angevine and danced on it without guide ropes. Still, the black wallet clutched in his right hand drew his mind to the fact that Father Chains had thought him right for whatever awaited him in this garden. Despite their scintillating danger, the roses were inanimate and unthinking. How could he have the heart of a killer if he feared to walk among them? Shame drove him forward, step by sliding step, and he threaded the twisting paths of the garden with exquisite care, sweat sliding down his face and stinging his eyes.
"I am a gentleman bastard," he muttered to himself.
It was the longest 30 feet of his brief life, that passage between the cold and waiting walls of roses. He didn't allow them a single taste of him. At the center of the garden was a circular courtyard about 30 feet wide. Here, 2 boys, roughly Jean's age, were circling one another, rapiers flicking and darting. Another half-dozen boys watched uneasily, along with a tall man of late middle age. This man had shoulder-length hair and drooping moustaches the colour of cold campfire ashes. His face was like sanded leather, and though he wore a gentleman's doublet in the same vivid red as the attendants downstairs, he wore it over weather-stained soldier's breeches and tattered field boots. There wasn't a boy at the lesson who didn't put his master's clothes to shame. These were sons of the quality, in brocade jackets and tailored breeches, silk tunics and polished imitations of swordsmen's boots. Each one also wore a white leather buff coat and silver-studded bracers of the same material. Just the thing for warding off thrusts from training weapons. Jean felt naked the instant he stepped into the clearing, and only the threat of the glass roses kept him from leaping back into concealment. One of the duelists was surprised to see Jean emerge from the garden, and his opponent made good use of that split second of inattention. He deftly thrust his rapier into the meat of the first boy's upper arm, punching through the leather. The skewered boy let out an unbecoming holler and dropped his blade.
"My lord Maranzala!"
One of the boys in the crowd spoke up, and there was more oil in his voice than there was on a blade put away for storage.
"Lorenzo was clearly distracted by the boy who just came out of the garden. That was not a fair strike."
Every boy in the clearing turned to regard Jean, and it was impossible to guess what soonest ignited their naked disdain. His labourer's clothing, his pear-like physique, his lack of weapons and armour. Only the boy with a spreading circle of blood on his tunic sleeve failed to stare at him with open loathing. He had other problems. The grey-haired man cleared his throat, then spoke in the deep voice Jean had heard earlier. He seemed amused.
"You were a fool to take your eyes from your opponent, Lorenzo. So in a sense you earned that sting. But it is true, all things being equal, that a young gentleman should not exploit an outside distraction to score a touch. You will both try to do better next time."
He pointed toward Jean without looking at him, and his voice lost its warmth.
"And you, boy, lose yourself in the garden until we've finished here. I don't want to see you again until these young gentlemen have left."
Certain that the fire rising in his cheeks could outshine the sun itself, Jean rapidly scuttled out of sight. Several seconds passed before he realized with horror that he had leapt back into the maze of sculpted glass walls without hesitation. Positioning himself a few bends back from the clearing, he stood in mingled fear and self-loathing, and tried to hold himself rigid as the sun's heat cooked great rivers of sweat out of him. Fortunately, he hadn't much longer to wait. The sound of steel on steel faded, and Don Maranzala dismissed his class. They filed past Jean with their coats off and their jackets open, each boy seemingly at ease with the lethal labyrinth of transparent blossoms. Not one said anything to Jean, for this was Don Maranzala's house, and it would be presumptuous of them to chastise a commoner within his domain. The fact that each boy had sweated his silk tunic to near translucency, and that several were red-faced and wobbly with sun-sickness, did little to leaven Jean's misery.
"Boy!"
called the Don after the troop of young gentlemen had passed out of the garden and down the stairs.
"Attend me now!"
Summoning as much dignity as he could, and realizing that most of it was pure imagination, Jean sucked in his wobbling belly and went out into the courtyard once again. Don Maranzala wasn't facing him. The Don held the undersized training rapier that had recently stung a careless boy's biceps. In his hands it looked like a toy, but the blood that glistened on its tip was quite real.
I'm sorry, sir, my lord Maranzala. I must have come early. I didn't mean to distract from the lesson."
The Don turned on his heel, smooth as Talvera clockwork, every muscle in his upper body ominously statue still. He stared down at Jean now, and the cold scrutiny of those black, squinting eyes gave Jean the third great scare of the afternoon. He suddenly remembered that he was alone on the roof with a man that had butchered his way into the position he currently held.
"Does it amuse you, lowborn?"
the Don asked in a serpentine whisper.
"To speak before you are spoken to, in a place such as this, to a man such as myself, to a Don?"
Jean's blubbered apology died in his throat with an unmanly choke, the sort of wet noise a clam might make if you broke its shell and squeezed it out through the cracks.
"Because if you're being merely careless, I'll beat that habit out of your butterfat ass before you can blink."
The Don strode over to the nearest wall of glass roses, and with evident care slid the tip of the bloodied rapier into one of the blossoms. Jean watched in horrified fascination as the red stain quickly vanished from the blade and was drawn into the glass, where it diffused into a mist-like pink tendril and was carried into the heart of the sculpture. The Don tossed the clean sword to the ground.
"Is that it? Are you a careless little fat boy, sent up here to pretend at arms? You're a dirty little urchin from the cauldron, no doubt. Some whore's god's damned droppings."
At first the paralysis of Jean's tongue refused to lift. Then he heard the blood pounding in his ears like the crashing of waves on a shore, his fists clenched on some impulse of their own.
"I was born in the north corner," he yelled, "and my mother and father were folk of business."
Almost as soon as he'd finished spitting this out, his heart seemed to stop. Mortified, he put his arms behind his back, bowed his head, and took a step backward. After a moment of weighted silence, Maranzala laughed loudly and cracked his knuckles with a sound like pine logs popping in a fire.
"You must forgive me, Jean," he said. "I wanted to see if Chains was telling the truth. By the gods, you do have balls and a temper."
"You..."
Jean stared at the Don, comprehension dawning.
"You wanted to make me angry, my lord?"
"I know you're sensitive about your parents, boy. Chains told me quite a bit about you."
The Don knelt on one knee before Jean, bringing them eye to eye, and put a hand on Jean's shoulder.
"Chains isn't blind," said Jean. "I'm not an initiate, and you're not really... not really..."
"A mean son of a bitch."
Jean giggled despite himself.
I wonder if I'll ever meet anyone who is what they seem to be ever again, my lord."
"You have. They walked out of my garden a few minutes ago. And I am a mean son of a bitch, Jean. You're going to hate my miserable old guts before this summer's out. You're going to curse me at false light and curse me at dawn."
"Oh," said Jean, "but that's just business."
"Very true," said Don Maranzala. "You know, I wasn't born to this place. It was a gift for services rendered. And don't think that I don't value it, but my mother and father weren't even from the north corner. I was actually born on a farm."
"Wow," said Jean.
"Yes. Up here in this garden, it won't matter who your parents were. I'll make you work until you sweat blood and plead for mercy. I'll thrash on you until you're inventing new gods to pray to. The only thing this garden respects is concentration. Can you concentrate every moment you're up here? Can you distill your attention, drive it down to the narrowest focus, live absolutely in the now and shut out all other concerns?"
I shall have to try, my lord. I already walked through the gardens once. I can do it again."
"You will do it again. You'll do it 1,000 times. You'll run through my roses. You'll sleep among them, and you'll learn to concentrate. I warn you, though, some men could not."
The Don arose and swept a hand in a semicircle before him.
"You can find what they left behind here and there, in the glass."
Jean swallowed nervously and nodded.
"Now, you tried to apologize before for coming early. Truth is, you didn't. I let my previous lesson run long because I tend to indulge those wretched little shits when they want to cut each other up a bit. In future, come at the stroke of one to make sure they're long gone. They cannot be allowed to see me teaching you."
Once Jean had been the son of substantial wealth, and he had worn clothes as fine as any just seen on this rooftop. What he felt now was the old sting of his loss, he told himself, and not mere shame for anything as stupid as his hair or his clothes or even his hanging belly. This thought was just self-importantly noble enough to keep his eyes dry and his face composed.
"I understand, my lord. I don't wish to embarrass you again."
"Embarrass me? Jean, you misunderstand."
Maranzala kicked idly at the toy rapier, and it clattered across the tiles of the rooftop.
"Those prancing little pants-wetters come here to learn the colourful and gentlemanly art of fencing. With its many sporting limitations and its prescriptions against dishonourable engagements. You, on the other hand," he said as he turned to give Jean a firm but friendly poke in the centre of his forehead, "you are going to learn how to kill men with a sword."
Chapter 7. Out the Window. 1. Locke outlined his plan over a long, nervous lunch. The gentleman bastard sat at the dining table in their glass burrow, just after noon on Duke's Day. Outside, the sun was pouring down its usual afternoon punishment, but in the burrow it was cool, perhaps unnaturally so, even for an underground cellar. Chains had often speculated that the elderglass did tricks with more than just light. They had laid on a feast more befitting a festival than a midday meeting. There was stewed mutton with onions and ginger, stuffed eels in spiced wine sauce, and green apple tarts baked by Jean, with a liberal dose of Osterschalen brandy poured over the fruit. "I'll bet even the Duke's own cook would have his balls skinned if he did this," he'd said. "Makes each tart worth 2 or 3 crowns, by my reckoning."
"What'll they be worth?" said Bug. "Once they're eaten, and they come out the other end."
"You're welcome to take measurements," said Carlo. "Grab a scale." "And a scoop," added Galdo.
The Sunzas spent the meal picking at a seasoned omelette topped with minced sheep's kidneys, usually a favourite with the whole table. But today, though they all agreed it was their best effort in weeks, topping even the celebration of their first success in the Salvara game, the savour seemed to have evaporated. Only Bug ate with real vigour, and his attention was largely concentrated on Jean's plate of tarts.
"Look at me," he said with his mouth half full. "I'm worth more with every bite."
Quiet half-smiles met his clowning, and nothing more. The boy harrumphed in annoyance and banged his fists on the table.
"Well, if none of you want to eat," he said, "why don't we get on with planning how we're going to dodge the axe tonight?"
"Indeed," said Jean.
"Too right," added Carlo.
"Yes," said Galdo.
"What's the game and how do we play it?"
"Well," Locke pushed his plate away, crumpled his cloth napkin, and threw it into the centre of the table.
"For starters, we need to use the damn broken tower rooms again. It seems the stairs aren't through with us just yet."
Jean nodded. "What will we do with the place?"
"That's where you and I will be when Andres comes looking to collect us at the 9th hour. And that's where we'll stay after he's thoroughly convinced that we have a very honest reason for not going with him."
"What reason would that be?" asked Carlo.
"A very colourful one," said Locke. "I need you and Galdo to pay a quick visit to Jessaline Dorbar this afternoon. I need help from a black alchemist for this. Here's what you tell her."
2. The illicit apothecary shop of Jessaline Dorbar and her daughter Janelaine was located above a scribe's collective in the respectable Fountain Bend neighbourhood. Carlo and Galdo stepped onto the scribing floor at just past the 2nd hour of the afternoon. Here a dozen men and women were hunched over wide wooden boards, working quills and salt and charcoal sticks, and drying sponges back and forth like automatons. A clever arrangement of mirrors and skylights let the natural light of day in to illuminate their work. There were few tradesfolk in Camor more penny-conscious than journeyman scriveners. At the rear of the first floor was a winding staircase, guarded by a tough-looking young woman who feigned boredom while fingering weapons beneath her brocaded brown coat. The Sansa twins established their bona fides with a combination of hand gestures and copper barons that made their way into the young woman's coat pockets. She tugged on a bell rope beside the stairs, then waved them up. On the second floor there was a reception room, windowless, walls and floor alike panelled with a golden hardwood that retained a faint aroma of pine lacquer. A tall counter divided the room precisely in half. There were no chairs on the customer side, and nothing at all on display on the merchant's side, just a single locked door. Jessalyn stood behind the counter, a striking woman in her mid-50s, with a tumbling cascade of charcoal-coloured hair and dark, wary eyes nestled in laugh lines. Janelaine, half her age, stood to her mother's right with a crossbow pointed just over Carlo and Galdo's heads. It was an indoor murder piece, lightweight and low power, which almost certainly meant some hideous poison on the quarrel. Neither Sansa was particularly bothered. This was business as usual for a black alchemist.
"Madame Dobar and Miss Dobar," said Carlo, bowing from the waist, "your servants." "Not to mention," said Galdo, "still very much available."
"Master Sansa and Master Sansa," said the elder Dobar, "pleased to see you." "Although we are," said Janelaine, "still very much disinclined." "Perhaps you'd care to buy something, though?"
Jessalyn folded her hands on the counter and raised one eyebrow.
"As it happens, a friend of ours needs something special."
Carlo fished a coin purse from under his waistcoat and held it in plain view without opening it.
"Special?"
"Or perhaps not so much special as specific. He's got to get sick. Very sick."
"Far be it from me to drive away business, my dears," said the elder Dobar. "But 3 or 4 bottles of rum would do the trick at a fraction of the price for anything I could give you."
"Ah, not that sort of sick," said Galdo. "He's got to be in a bad way, like to knocking on Death Goddess bedchamber and asking if he can come in. And then he's got to be able to recover his strength after playing ill for a while, a sort of mummer's sick, if you will."
"Hmm," said Janelaine. "I don't know if we have anything that works quite like that, at least not on hand." "When," said Jessalyn, "would your friend require a solution by?"
"We were sort of hoping to walk out of here with one," said Carlo.
"We don't brew miracles, my dears."
Jessalyn drummed her fingers on her countertop.
"Contrary to all common belief, we do prefer a bit of notice for something like this. Messing about with someone's inside, fit to ill and then fit again in the span of a few hours, well, that's delicate." "We're not bonds, Magi," added Janelaine.
"Praise the gods for that," said Galdo, "but it's very pressing."
"Well," sighed Jessalyn, "perhaps we can bang something together. A bit on the crude, but it might do the trick." "Barrel robber's blossom," said her daughter. "Yes," Jessalyn nodded, "and somnay pine after." "I believe we've both in the shop," Janelaine said. "Shall I check?" "Do, and hand over that alley piece while you're back there."
Janelaine passed the crossbow to her mother, then unlocked the door at the rear of the room and disappeared, closing it behind her once again. Jessalyn set the weapon gently down atop the counter, keeping one long-fingered hand on the tiller.
"You wound us, madam," said Carlo. "We're harmless as kittens." "More so," said Galdo. "Kittens have claws and piss on things indiscriminately."
"It's not just you, boys. It's the city. Whole place is like the boil, what with Nazca getting clipped. Old Barsavi's got to have some retribution in the works. God knows who this Grey King is or what he wants, but I'm more worried by the day for what might come up my stairs."
"It's a messy time," said Carlo.
Janelaine returned with two small pouches in her hands. She locked the door behind her, passed the pouches to her mother, and picked up the crossbow once again.
"Well," said the elder Daubard, "here's what it is, then. Your friend takes this, the red pouch. It's barrel-robber's blossom, a sort of purple powder. In the red pouch, remember. Put it in water. It's an emetic, if the word means anything to you."
"Nothing pleasant," said Galdo.
5 minutes after he drinks it, he gets an ache in the belly. 10 minutes, and he gets wobbly at the knees. 15 minutes, and he starts vomiting up every meal he's had for the past week. Won't be pretty. Have buckets close at hand.
"And it'll look absolutely real?" asked Carlo.
"Look? Sweetmeat, it'll be as real as it gets. You ever see anyone feign vomiting?"
"Yes," said the Sanzas in perfect unison. "He does this thing with chewed-up oranges," added Galdo.
"Well, your friend won't be feigning this. Any physicker in Camor would swear it was a real and natural distress. You can't even see the barrel-robber's blossom once it comes up. It dissolves quickly."
"And then," said Carlo, "what about the other pouch?"
"This is Somne pine bark. Crumble it and steep it in a tea. It's the perfect counter for the purple blossom. It'll cancel it right out. But the blossom will already have done its work. Keep that in mind. The bark won't put food back in his belly, or give back the vigor he loses while he's retching his guts out. He's going to be weak and sore for at least an evening or two."
"Sounds wonderful," said Carlo. "By our own peculiar definition of wonderful, what do we owe you?"
3 crowns, 20 solons, said Jessalyn. "And that's only because you were old chains boys. This isn't much by way of alchemy, just refined and purified, but the powders are hard to get hold of."
Carlo counted out 20 gold tyrins from his purse and set them atop the counter in a vertical stack.
"Here's 5 crowns, then, with the understanding that this transaction is best forgotten by everyone involved."
"Sansa," said Jessalyn Daubard without humour, "every purchase at my shop is forgotten, as far as the outside world is concerned."
"Then this one," said Carlo, adding 4 more tyrins to the pile, "needs to stay extra forgotten."
"Well, if you really want to reinforce the point..."
She pulled a wooden scraper from beneath the counter and used it to pull the coins over the back edge into what sounded like a leather bag. She was careful not to touch the coins themselves. Black alchemists rarely got to be her age if they relaxed their paranoia toward all things touched, tasted, or smelled.
"You have our thanks," said Galdo, "and that of our friend as well."
"Oh, don't count on that," Jessalyn Daubard chuckled. "Give him the red pouch first, then see what a grateful frame of mind it puts him in."
3. "Get me a glass of water, Jean." Locke stared out the canal-side window of the 7th-floor room as the buildings of southern Camor grew long black shadows toward the east.
"It's time to take my medicine. I'm guessing it's close on 9:20.
"Already set," said Jean, passing over a tin cup with a cloudy lavender residue swirling in it. "That stuff did dissolve in a blink, just like the Sansa said."
"Well," he said, "here's to deep pockets poorly guarded. Here's to true alchemists, a strong stomach, a clumsy grey king, and the luck of the crooked warden."
"Here's to living out the night," said Jean, miming the clink of a cup against Locke's own. Locke sipped hesitantly, then tilted the cup back and poured it down his throat in one smooth series of gulps.
"Actually not bad at all. Tastes minty, very refreshing."
"A worthy epitaph," said Jean, taking the cup. Locke stared out the window a while longer. The mesh was up, as the Duke's wind was still blowing in strongly from the sea, and the insects weren't yet biting. Across the Via Camarazza, the arsenal district was mostly silent and motionless. With the Iron Sea city-states at relative peace, all the great saw-yards and warehouses and wet docks had little business. In a time of need, they could build or service 24 ships at once. Now Locke could see only one skeletal hull rising within the yards. Beyond that, the sea broke white against the base of the South Needle, an elderglass-mortared stone breakwater nearly 3/4 of a mile in length. At its southernmost tip, a human-built watchtower stood out against the darkening sea. Beyond that, the white blurs of sails could be seen beneath the red tendrils of clouds in the sky. "Oh," he said, "I do believe something's happening." "Take a seat," said Jean. "You're supposed to get wobbly in just a bit." "Already happening. In fact, gods, I think I'm going to..." So it began. A great wave of nausea bubbled up in Locke's throat, and with it came everything he'd eaten for the past day. For a few long minutes he crouched on his knees, clutching a wooden bucket as devoutly as any man had ever prayed over an altar for intercession from the gods.
"Jean!"
he gasped out during a brief lull between spasms of retching.
"Next time I conceive a plan like this, consider planting a hatchet in my skull."
Hardly efficacious. Jean swapped a full bucket for an empty one and gave Locke a friendly pat on the back. "Dulling my nice sharp blades on a skull as thick as yours." One by one, Jean shuttered the windows. False light was just rising outside. "Ghastly as it is," he said, "we need the smell to make an impression when Andres shows up." Even once Locke's stomach was thoroughly emptied, the dry heaving continued. He shuddered and shook and moaned, clutching at his guts. Jean hauled him bodily over to a sleeping pallet, where he looked down in genuine worry. "You're pale and clammy," he muttered. "Not bad at all. Very realistic."
"Pretty, isn't it? Gods!" whispered Locke. "How much longer?"
"Can't rightly say," said Jean. "They should be arriving down there right about now. Give them a few minutes to get impatient with waiting around for us and come storming up here." During those few minutes, Locke became intimately acquainted with the idea of a short eternity. Finally, there came the creak of footsteps on the stairs and a loud banging on the door.
"Lamora!" Angers Barsavi's voice. "Tannen, open up or I'll kick the damn door in."
"Thank the gods,"
croaked Locke as Jean rose to unbolt the door.
"We've been waiting out front of the last mistake. Are you coming or... Gods, what the hell happened in here?"
Andres threw one arm up over his face as he stepped into the apartment and the smell of sickness. Jean pointed to Locke, writhing on the bed, moaning, half wrapped in a thin blanket despite the moist heat of the evening.
"He took ill just 30 minutes ago, maybe," said Jean, "losing his stomach all over the damn place. I don't know what's the matter."
"Gods, he's turning green!"
Andres took a few steps closer to Locke, staring in horrified sympathy. He was dressed for a fight, with a boiled leather cuirass, an unbuckled leather collar, and a pair of studded leather braces tied over his ham-like forearms. Several men had accompanied him up the stairs, but none of them seemed in any hurry to follow him into the rooms.
"I had capon for lunch," said Jean, "and he had fish rolls. That's the last thing either of us ate, and I'm fine."
"Yono's piss. Fish rolls. Fresher than he bargained for, I'd wager."
"Andres,"
Locke croaked, reaching out toward him with a shaking hand.
Don't leave me. I can still go. I can still fight."
"Gods, no." Andres shook his head emphatically. "You're in a bad way, Lamora. I think you'd best see a physicker. Have you summoned one, Tannen?"
"I haven't had a chance. I fetched out the buckets and I've been looking after him since it started."
"Well, keep it up. Both of you stay. No, don't get angry, Jean. He clearly can't be left on his own. Stay and tend him. Fetch a physical when you can."
Andres gave Locke 2 brief pats on his exposed shoulder.
"We'll get the fucker tonight, Locke. No worries. We'll do him for good, and I'll send someone to look in on you when we're done. I'll square this with Papa. He'll understand."
"Please,
Please, Jean can help me stand. I can still...
End of discussion. You can't fucking stand up. You're sick as a fish dropped in a wine bottle.
Andres backed toward the door and gave Locke a brief sympathetic wave before he ducked out.
If I get my hands on the bastard personally, I'll deck him once for you, Locke. Rest easy.
Then the door slammed, and Locke and Jean were alone once again. 4. Long minutes passed. Jean unshuttered the canal-side window and stared out into the glimmer of false light. He watched as Andres and his men broke loose from the crowds below, then hurried across a Via Camarazza cat bridge and into the arsenal district. Andres didn't look back even once, and soon enough he was swallowed up by shadows and distance.
Long gone.
Can I help you out of... Jean said, turning away from the window. Locke had already stumbled out of bed and was splashing water on the alchemical hearthstone, looking 10 years older and 20 pounds thinner. That was alarming. Locke didn't have 20 pounds to spare.
Lovely. The least complicated, least important job of the night is done. Carry on, gentlemen bastards, said Locke.
His face was alight in the reflected glow of the simmering stone as he set a glazed jug of water atop it. 10 years older? More like 20.
Now for the tea, gods bless it, and it had better be as good as the purple powder.
Jean grimaced and grabbed the 2 vomit buckets Locke had used, then moved back to the window. False light was dying down now. The hangman's wind was blowing up warm and strong, bringing a low ceiling of dark clouds with it, visible just past the 5 towers. The moons would be swallowed by those clouds tonight, at least for a few hours. Pinpricks of firelight were appearing across the city as though an unseen jeweler were setting his wares out on a field of black cloth.
"Jessalyn's little potion seems to have brought up every meal I've had in the past 5 years," said Locke. "Nothing left to spit up but my naked soul. Make sure it isn't floating around in one of those before you toss them, right?"
His hands shook as he crumbled the dry somnay pine bark right into the jug of water. He didn't feel like messing about with proper tea brewing.
"I think I see it," Jean said. "Nasty, crooked little thing it is, too. You're better off with it floating out to sea."
Jean took a quick glance out the window to ensure that there were no canal boats drifting below in the path of a truly foul surprise, then simply flung the buckets one after the other. They hit the grey water 70-odd feet below with loud splashes, but Jean was certain nobody noticed or cared. Camorri were always throwing disgusting things into the Via Camarazza. Satisfied with his aim, Jean then slid the hidden closet open and pulled out their disguises, cheap traveller's cloaks and a pair of broad-brimmed Talvarar caps fashioned from some ignoble leather with the greasy texture of sausage casings. He flung one brownish-grey cloak over Locke's shoulders. Locke clutched at it gratefully and shivered.
"You've got that motherly concern in your eyes, Jean. I must look like hammered shit."
"Actually, you look like you were executed last week. I hate to ask, but are you sure you're going to be up for this?"
"Whatever I am, it has to be sufficient."
Locke wrapped one end of his cloak around his right hand and picked up the jug of half-boiled tea. He sipped and swallowed, bark and all, reasoning that the best place for the stuff would be his empty stomach.
"Ugh! It tastes like a kick in the gut feels. Have I pissed Jessalyn off recently, too?"
His expression was picturesque, as though the skin of his face were trying to peel itself back and leap off his bones. But he continued to choke the near tea down anyway. Jean steadied him by placing both hands on his shoulders, privately afraid that another bout of vomiting might be more than Locke could handle. After a few minutes, Locke set the empty jug down and sighed deeply.
"I can't wait to have words with the Grey King when this shit is all finished," Locke whispered. "There's a few things I want to ask him. Philosophical questions, like, how does it feel to be dangled out a window by a rope tied around your balls, motherfucker?"
"Sounds more like physic than philosophy. But as you said, we have to wait for the falconer to leave first."
Jean's voice was steady and totally empty of emotion. the voice he always used when discussing a plan only loosely tethered to prudence and sanity. Pity we can't just blindside the bastard from an alley. Couldn't give him so much as a second to think, or we'd lose. Anything less than 20 yards, mused Jean. One good throw with a wicked sister. Wouldn't take but half a second.
But you and I both know, Locke replied slowly, that we can't kill a bondsmage. We wouldn't live out the week. Carthane would make examples of us, plus Carlo, Galdo, and Bug as well. Not very clever at all, that way out. A drawn-out suicide.
Locke stared down at the fading glow of the hearthstone and rubbed his hands together. I wonder, Jean, I really wonder, is this what other people feel like when we're through with them? After we get the goods and pull the vanish and there's nothing they can do about it? The light from the hearthstone sank several stages further before Jean answered. I thought we'd agreed long ago that they get what they deserve, Locke. Nothing more. This is a fantastically silly moment to start giving a shit.
Giving a shit?
Locke started, blinking as though he had just woken up. No, don't get me wrong. It's just this sewn-up feeling. No way out is for other people, not for the gentleman bastards. I don't like being trapped. At a sudden gesture from Locke, Jean pulled him to his feet. Jean wasn't sure if the tea was any more responsible than the cloak, but Locke was no longer shivering.
Too right, Locke continued, his voice gaining strength. Too right, I don't like it. Let's get this shit job over with. We can have a good ponder on the subject of our favourite grey ratfucker and his pet mage after I've danced to their little tune.
Jean grinned and cracked his knuckles, then ran a hand down the small of his back. The old familiar gesture, making sure that the wicked sisters were ready for a night out.
You sure, he said, that you're ready for the Vine Highway?
Ready as I can be, Jean. Hell, I weigh considerably less than I did before I drank that potion. Climbing down'll be the easiest thing I do all night.
5. The trellis ran up the full height of the broken tower on the westward face of the structure, overlooking a narrow alley. The lattice of wood was threaded with tough old vines and built around the windows on each floor. Though something of a bitch to climb, it was the perfect way to avoid the few dozen familiar faces that were sure to be in the last mistake on any given night. The gentleman bastards used the Vine Highway frequently. The alley-side shutters banged open on the top floor of the broken tower. All the light inside Locke and Jean's suite of rooms had been extinguished. A large, dark shape slid out into the mass of trellised vines, and was shortly followed by a smaller shape. Clinging with white-knuckled determination, Locke gently eased the shutters closed above him, then willed his queasy stomach to quit complaining for the duration of the climb. The hangman's wind, on its way out to the salty blackness of the iron sea, caught at his cap and cloak with invisible fingers that smelled of marshes and farmers' fields. Jean kept himself 2 or 3 feet under Locke, and they descended steadily, one foothold or handhold at a time. The windows on the 6th floor were shuttered and dark. Thin slivers of amber light could be seen around the shutters on the 5th floor. Both climbers slowed without the need for words and willed themselves to be as quiet as possible, to be patches of grey invisible against deeper darkness, nothing more. They continued down. The 5th floor shutters flew outward as Jean was abreast with them on their left. One hinged panel rebounded off his back, almost startling him out of his hold on the trellis. He curled his fingers tightly around wood and vine and looked to his right. Locke stepped on his head in surprise, but quickly pulled himself back up.
"I know there's no other way out, you miserable bitch!"
hissed a man's voice. There was a loud thump, and then a shudder ran up and down the trellis. Someone else had just gone out the window, and was scrabbling in the vines beside and just below them. A black-haired woman stuck her head out of the window, intent on yelling something in return, but when she caught sight of Jean through the cracks in her swinging shutter, she gasped. This in turn drew the attention of the man clinging just beneath her, a larger man even than Jean.
"What the hell is this shit?"
he gasped. "What are you doing outside this window?"
"Amusing the gods, asshole." Jean kicked down and tried to nudge the newcomer further down the trellis, to no avail. "Kindly heave yourself down."
"What are you doing outside this window, huh? You like to sneak a peek? You can sneak a peek of my fist, cocksucker!"
Grunting with exertion, he began to climb back upward, grabbing at Jean's legs. Jean narrowly yanked himself out of the way, and the world reeled around him as he regained his balance. Black wall, black sky, wet black cobblestones 50 feet below. That was a bad fall, the kind that cracked men like eggs.
"All of you, get off my damned window now! Ferens, for Morganti's sake, leave them be and get down!"
the woman hollered.
"Shit!"
Locke muttered from a few feet above and to her left, his eloquence temporarily cowed into submission.
"Madam, you're complicating our night, so before we come in and complicate yours, kindly cork your bullshit bottle and close the god's damned window!"
She looked up aghast.
"Two of you? All of you, get down! Get down! Get down! Close your window! Close your window! Close your fucking window!" "I'll kill both you shit-suckers!"
huffed Ferenz.
"Drop you both off this fucking..."
There was a marrow-chillingly loud cracking noise, and the trellis shuddered beneath the hands of the three men clinging to it.
"Ah," said Locke. "Ah, that figures. Thanks ever so much, Ferenz."
Then there was a torrent of polysyllabic blasphemy from four mouths. Exactly who said what would never be clearly recalled. Two careful men were apparently the trellis limit. Under the weight of three careless flailers, it began to tear free of the stone wall with a series of creaks and pops. Ferenc surrendered to gravity and common sense and began sliding downward at prodigious speed, burning his hands as he went, all but peeling the trellis off the wall above him. It finally gave way when he was about 20 feet above the ground, flipping over and dashing him down into the darkened alley, where he was promptly covered in falling vines and wood. His descent had snapped off a section of trellis at least 30 feet long, starting just beneath Jean's dangling feet. Wasting no time, Locke shimmied to his right and dropped down onto the window ledge, shoving the screaming woman back with the tip of one boot. Jean scrambled upward, for the shutter still blocked his direct access to the window, and as the section of trellis under his hands began to pull out of the wall, he gracelessly swung himself over the shutter and in through the window, taking Locke with him. They wound up in a heap on the hardwood floor, tangled in cloaks.
"Get back out the fucking window now!"
the woman screamed, punctuating each word with a swift kick to Jean's back and ribs. Fortunately, she wasn't wearing shoes.
"That would be stupid," Locke said, from somewhere under his larger friend. "Hey!" Jean said. "Hey! Hey!"
He caught the woman's foot and propelled her backward. She landed on her bed. It was the sort commonly called a dangler, a two-person hammock of strong but lightweight demi-silk, anchored to the ceiling at four points. She went sprawling across it, and both Locke and Jean suddenly noticed that she wasn't wearing anything but her small clothes. In the summer, a Komori woman's small clothes are small indeed.
"Out, you bastards! Out! Out! I..."
As Locke and Jean stumbled to their feet, the door on the wall opposite the window slammed open, and in stepped a broad-shouldered man with the slab-like muscles of a stevedore or a smith. Vengeful satisfaction gleamed in his eyes, and the smell of hard liquor rolled off him, sour and acute even from 10 paces away. Locke wasted half a second wondering how Ferenc had gotten back upstairs so quickly, and another half second realizing that the man in the doorway wasn't Ferenc. He giggled, briefly but uncontrollably. The night wind slammed the shutter against the open window behind him. The woman made a noise somewhere in the back of her throat, a noise not unlike a cat falling down a deep, dark well.
"You filthy bitch!"
the man said, his speech a thick, slow drawl.
"Filthy, filthy bitch! I just knew it! Knew you weren't alone!"
He spat, then shook his head at Locke and Jean.
"Two guys at once, too! Damn! Go figure. Guess it takes that many to replace me. Hope you boys had yourselves a fun time with another man's woman, he continued, drawing 9 inches of blackened steel stiletto from his left boot. "'Cause now I'm gonna make you women!'
Jean spread his feet and moved his left hand under his cloak, ready to draw the sisters. With his right hand he nudged Locke a pace behind him.
"'Hold it!' Locke cried, waving both of his hands. "'I know what this looks like, but you've got the wrong idea, friend!'
He pointed at the petrified woman clinging to the hanging bed.
"'She came before we came!'
"'Gethys!'
hissed the woman.
"'Gethys, these men attack me! Get them! Save me!'
Gethys charged at Jean, growling. He held his knife out before him in the grip of an experienced fighter, but he was still drunk and he was still angry. Locke dodged out of the way as Jean caught Gethys by his wrist, stepped inside his reach, and sent him sprawling to the floor with a quick sweep of the legs. There was an unappetizing snapping noise, and the blade fell from Gethys' grip. Jean had retained a firm hold on his wrist, and then twisted as the man went down on his back. For a moment Gethys was too bewildered to cry out, then the pain broke through to his dulled senses, and he roared. Jean hoisted him up off the ground with one quick yank by the front of his tunic, and then he shoved Gethys with all his might into the stone wall to the left of the window. The big man's head bounced off the hard surface, and he stumbled forward. The blurred arc of Jean's right fist met his jaw with a crack, abruptly cancelling his forward momentum. He flopped to the ground, boneless as a sack of dough.
"Yes!" cried the woman. "Now throw him out the window!"
"For the love of the gods, madam," snapped Locke, "can you please pick one man in your bedroom to cheer for and stick with him?"
"If he's found dead in the alley beneath your window," said Jean, "I'll come back and give you the same."
"And if you tell anyone that we came through here," added Locke, "you'll only wish he'd come back and given you the same."
"Gethys will remember," she screeched. "He'll certainly remember."
"A big man like him? Please."
Jean made a show of arranging his cloak and redonning his hat. "He'll say it was 8 men and they all had clubs." Locke and Jean hurried out the door through which Gethys had entered, which led to the landing of the 5th-floor steps on the north side of the tower. With the trellis damaged, there was nothing else for it but to proceed quickly down on foot and pray to the crooked warden. Locke drew the door closed behind them, leaving the bewildered woman sprawled on her hanging bed, with the unconscious Gethys curled up beside her window.
"The luck of the gods must certainly be with us," said Locke as they hurried down the creaking steps. "At least we didn't lose these stupid fucking hats."
A small dark shape hissed past them, wings fluttering, a sleek shadow visible as it swooped between them and the lights of the city.
"Well," Locke added, "for better or worse, from this point on, I suppose we're under the falconer's wing."
Interlude. Up the River. 1. Jean was away at the House of Glass Roses the afternoon that Locke found out he was going to be sent up the Angevine to live on a farm for several months. Hard rains were pounding Camorre that idler's day, so Chains had taken Locke, Carlo, and Galdo down into the dining room to teach them how to play Rich Man, Beggar Man, Soldier Man, Duke, a card game that revolved around attempting to cheat one's neighbour out of every last bent copper at his disposal. Naturally, the boys took to it quickly.
2, 3, and 5 of spires, said Carlo, plus the sigil of the 12. Die screaming, half-wit, said Galdo. I've got a run of chalices and the sigil of the sun. Won't do you any good, quarter-wit. Hand over your coins.
Actually, said Father Chains, a sigil run beats a sigil stand, Carlo. Galdo would have you. Except,
doesn't anyone care what I've got in my hand? Asked Locke.
Not particularly, said Chains, since nothing in the game tops a full duke's hand.
He set his cards on the table and cracked his knuckles with great satisfaction.
That's cheating, said Locke. That's 6 times in a row, and you've had the duke's hand for 2 of them.
"Of course I'm cheating," said Chains. "Game's no fun unless you cheat. When you figure out how I'm cheating, then I'll know you're starting to improve."
"You shouldn't have told us that," said Carlo.